But can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, which is good, because we're here to start end credits. Here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, I am your host, being heard, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage, with no pun about being heard. Nobody ever hears a woman talk.
Oh, I'm not sure that's true. That's quite the controversial thing to start the show on, too.
Yeah, well, you know. Controversy, that's what I'm here for.
I don't know, I'm a white man between 18 and 59, everyone has to listen to me. But I digress. End credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new superhero horror movie, Brightburn. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including Indiana Jones. Harrison Ford says when he dies, Indiana Jones dies. But what are the odds of that happening? And then Godzilla is back in theaters this past weekend, but... do we remember the subtle message of the monster, and is that taking a backseat to the franchising of Godzilla? And then finally, Booksmart opened with just $16.9 million last weekend, so is that a failure? Anyway, our first topic, though, we are going to... let me grab my notepad, because it's just not here in front of me like it should be. Anyway, so... if you may have heard the news lately, there's some controversy going on in the United States. Maybe
some.
A bit. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so hard to quantify it now because it's like there's controversy every day.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular reference, several states in the United States are passing draconian abortion laws, including the state of Georgia. And we particularly highlight the state of Georgia because it is where it's called... Yollywood.
Oh, is that what they're supposed to the... what do we call the North Hollywood of Vancouver?
I think it's just Hollywood North.
Hollywood North, yeah. Either way, yes.
Nobody got that creative when it came to Vancouver or Toronto. But Georgia and in the greater Atlantic area are big... it's a big Hollywood hub for production, mostly thanks to some lucrative tax credits that the government offers. But there's 455 productions that are expected to shoot in and around Georgia this year. And there's been particularly some pressure on Hollywood to respond to the what they call the heartbeat bill. Basically, it's just, you know, it's a law starting in January that if you are a woman and want an abortion and you are 6 weeks pregnant or more, you cannot get one. Of course, this is, and we talked about this on Open Sources a couple of weeks ago, that is wholly impractical since a lot of women don't know they're pregnant till after 6 weeks.
Yeah.
But we'll let a woman extrapolate further on this issue instead of mansplaining.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, I mean, the literal, you know, date of 6 weeks is a serious problem because obviously that pretty much discounts 98% of women's pregnancies. Like,
also thoroughly unscientific too.
Just a random date that gives no, like, there's nothing in there. Yeah,
I don't mean to cut in with more mansplaining, but from what I understand, my tremendous experience in the field of obstetrician and gynecology, but no, that you know, they call it the heartbeat bill, but it's because there's electrical impulses in the fetus that just, some people say is a heartbeat, but
it is
probably
not
isn't
a heartbeat. Yeah. It's a peanut. Yeah. If I think I think by about 12 weeks they say it's the size of a walnut.
Mm.
Like there is no heart. There's no. Right. It's just it's goo in a petri dish that is a woman. Not that I want to call a woman a petri dish, but seriously, like,
too late. Too late. It's on
to
the
be
record.
Fair,
yeah,
I'm a little I am terrified of childbirth and child
fair.
Like it
fair.
To me it is just this, and there is actually quite a lot of really amazing horror films that sort of liken, you know, pregnancy to, like, it's just this thing growing inside a woman's body, which is both miraculous and terrifying. And so I know a lot of women who have gone through this, so they talk about all the different stages. They're like, it, you know, it's nothing right now. It's nothing. But at the same time, there are women who, even though it's just, you know, cells in a petri dish, still already care, obviously. Mm-hmm. And right from the very beginning, once a woman knows that they are pregnant, suddenly everything changes. Everything. And there are so many decisions that need to be made. And this whole abortion thing coming up, to me, one is mind-boggling at this time in our society.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating because it's emboldening other people. I don't know if you saw just this weekend here in Guelph, there was a huge group of people, and by huge, I mean like 25 or 30,
mm-hmm.
Anti-abortionists who were doing the rounds from the cenotaph over to the train bridge along Wellington. Mm. And there are people there at that cenotaph, usually two or three people, mm-hmm. you know, every once in a while. And I don't like seeing it, but suddenly here's this very large group of mostly white women and children between the ages of newborn to about 10. Walking around carrying signs. And this wouldn't have happened a month ago. They wouldn't have felt they could do that unless, yeah. So I don't know how I feel. I'm of two minds with Georgia and with so many places deciding to pull out of filming there. At first, I thought, perfect, this is exactly what needs to happen. States, you know, these legislators need to understand the consequences of what they do. Since they're not going to understand the consequence of what they do on women, maybe they can understand it the way that politicians seem to work, which is based on economy, which is fine. I mean, that's, you know, there's right. two reasons legislators have their job. It's to protect people and to, you know, make sure the economy works.
Right,
so,
right, right. Oh, yeah.
You know, I am glad to see that so many places have taken this and immediately said, no, like, we are against this bill and we're going to do something about it. Interestingly, I listen to a lot of podcasts from the How Stuff Works group, which is based out of Atlanta. And Stuff Mom Never Told You, which is the one that's very feminist-based. It's geared to women. It's by women. And they cover a lot of topics like this. They were talking about how they actually, while they appreciate the sentiment of all these places saying, we are not going to do business with you if this happens,
right.
they made a really great point, which I actually kind of agree with, which is, yeah, but when all these people leave, then they're leaving us alone. There are those of us here who do want to fight against
this,
and all of our allies are leaving now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understand J.J. Abrams and a particular, I'm not sure what production company he's with, but
Bad
they
have... Bad Robot.
Yeah, but I'm not sure what it is they're producing.
Yeah,
there.
Him and Jordan Peele are producing, I think it's called Lovecraft County.
Oh, that sounds great. But but they have committed to
right.
You know, donating profits from their work to organizations that are fighting these laws, which I think is an even bigger statement.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, in some cases, boycotts do work, and everybody always goes back to the apartheid of South Africa and how boycotting, you know, cultural boycotting and some economic boycotting really made a difference there. But I don't know, did it make a difference? It still took a really long time for apartheid to not be legal anymore.
Well, I mean, there's still issues in South Africa that stem from that. And you can also make the point that still issues in the United States that stem from slavery 150 years after the fact.
Yes, like a heartbeat bill.
Yeah, right.
In a place like Georgia, where white women can go see doctors who will just get it taken care of without, it won't even be a, you know, but a black woman who has to go to a clinic and doesn't have a, you know, their own doctor and are already faced with, well, all of the things that happened to you in your life are because of the decisions you made, not because of any systemic racism.
Right, and it's the money argument is what's compelling here, and also what's compelling is one of the studios put out a statement. I think it was Warner Brothers, Warner Media, that you know they will work in territories, and it's sometimes above the point that you know they're working in places where they may have disagreements culturally with the local government. So you know what's powerful here is I don't think the pressure is coming from the corporate level, from the circumstances on the ground, because I don't think anybody at Disney or Netflix or whoever cares.
Yeah.
But of course, they represent a huge pool of talent who tend to be predominantly liberal, predominantly socially liberal, who are putting pressure on them. And it's like, well, I don't want to go to Georgia. I don't want to go to these places. And so they're having to walk a fine line. So I think the fact that these big studios, Disney and all of them, the fact that they did respond.
It reminds you that money does talk.
Yeah. That's almost a remarkable statement in its own right, that if you have big media conglomerates putting out press releases about reconsidering relationships with certain jurisdictions because of laws passed. I mean, I think, you know, speaking of recent boycotts, the trans bathroom ban in Indiana when Mike Pence was governor of Indiana. I don't think any of that ever went through, but the mere threat of it made them pull back from consideration, or at least change it to make it quote unquote palatable.
Yeah. But, and, you know, that's you and I. You know, it's our power. Now, of course, in this case, we're probably talking about the talent, which is primarily probably the actors. But I'm sure, you know, crew as well, too, who are saying, you know, I just don't want to do that. And, you know, it reminds me of, was it Emma Thompson who just left a film because she felt that whatever the case was, I don't really remember, but, you know, seeing more actors saying, you know what, you know, this contract is not, you know, equal for everybody, or you're not hiring enough.
She left a production of, she was doing the voice in a film for Skydance, which hired John Lasseter as a creative director. And so she left that production because of the circumstances around John Lasseter's departure from
Disney. And
these
people,
Pixar.
I mean, most of these people, and sure, some of them are, you know, working actors, and they are still sort of, you know, they it's not like they're all millionaires, but, you know, many of them are in a very comfortable position. And the more often they and all of us can make whatever decision we can to say, I will not support this, it helps to sway, you know, and in many ways, you know, more than just writing to your government, which also helps, but just, you know, taking your power back, which in this society is essentially economy, so taking your money back.
Well, it's interesting, like a lot of those old-fashioned things like boycotts, like actually calling your government representative. Actually calling your government representative is more powerful than like sending an email or S-posting them on Twitter or something like that. So, you know, these kind of old-fashioned things are really key. And if you're Brian Kemp, who's the governor of Georgia, and you're hearing from Disney, all the Marvel movies shoot in Georgia. When you're hearing from Netflix, Stranger Things, their biggest show shoots in Georgia. AMC, their biggest show, The Walking Dead, shoots in Georgia. That's just not like jobs for studios or jobs for actors and jobs for crew. It's local economy. It's restaurants. It's the tourism business. I'm sure there's somewhere in Georgia where it's like The Walking Dead tour where you can go and visit like Herschel's farm and the prison and other locations.
I mean, I've done that in North Carolina, right? Because North Carolina used to be for a very long time a huge place for filming, and I've gone there and visited, you know, many film places. So
mostly related to Dawson's Creek.
Mostly related to Dawson's Creek, yes.
I wanted to put that caveat.
I also saw some of the filming of what was a Vince Vaughn and John Travolta film where it was a Stepdad or something like that. It wasn't Stepdad because that was a different film, but it was the same sort of thing.
Oh.
Where
I can't remember.
I don't remember the name of it, but I watched some of the filming at Let's Google. This is what live radio is like. Pause while we Google.
No, it's true.
Fill the time, Candace.
Domestic disturbance?
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, that's not like Stepdads at all.
No.
It's
no, not Stepdads. Sorry. There is a horror-ish film called Stepdad.
Yeah.
Which is not Stepdads. That's
right.
Different. That's
I thought you were thinking about the Mark Wahlberg, Will Ferrell one.
No, I wasn't. No, I was thinking of the one that's Stepdad, which is I can see his face. He's like a TV actor.
Oh, you mean Stepfather.
Stepfather, yeah.
With Penn Badgley.
No, that's...
Oh, you mean the original one, Terry O'Quinn.
Terry O'Quinn.
Yes.
See, there I am. Like, television. He's a television face.
You know, television. Anyway.
And that, my friend, was a deep dive.
That was a deep dive. Let's go on to Indiana Jones, because Indiana Jones 5 is currently scheduled for a summer 2021 release. Harrison Ford, who is doing a voice in The Secret Life of Pets 2, and that's why he was being interviewed.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever. He's a working actor.
He's allowed to do stuff. But he was on the Today Show, and they were asking about him about potential replacements who could take over the mantle of Indiana Jones, and he says, "Nobody is going to be Indiana Jones. Don't you get it? When I'm gone, he's gone." I may have read that a bit angrier than him.
A little bit.
He was kind of joking in that clip.
Yeah.
But this kind of...
I'm okay with that.
Yeah?
We can let our heroes die and start new stories. We can even start, like... It's so frustrating to me. Do we have to reboot Indiana Jones? It is fine. You can just create a different... Indiana Jones. And call him something different. Make him not a professor of archaeology, but like a professor of some other thing. And, you know,
Okay. I got it. What if it's a symbology professor from Harvard who discovers
that's
secrets
a Dan Brown book.
About, oh.
But see, you can do that, though. That's the thing, right? Nobody was sitting there watching right. Angels and Demons and Da Vinci Code going, well, this is just Indiana Jones. I mean, some people might have been, but it's okay. Even American Treasure, is that what it's called? Nicolas Cage?
Treasure.
National Treasure? It's all just Indiana Jones, and it's fine.
National Treasure is literally Indiana Jones meets the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah. And it was a whole lot of fun.
It was okay. It had its moments.
I didn't say it was good. I said it was a whole lot of fun.
Yeah.
Like most Nicolas Cage films.
Diane Kruger is... really underestimated as an actress, I'll say that. But it is sort of funny because if he was serious, I just wanted to say the names George Hall, Sean Patrick Flattery, and Corey Carrier, who all played Indiana Jones in the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles.
Mm-hmm.
George Hall was the older Indiana Jones.
Let's not forget River Phoenix.
And River Phoenix,
who was the young... I mean, young
so
Indiana Jones started because of the scene from The Last Crusade.
Yeah, and they wanted River Phoenix for the show, but...
He was too big a star then.
He was too big a star, and not to get into, like, what-if scenarios, but, mm-hmm. you know, maybe doing TV might have saved his life. I don't know. Who knows? I do agree with you to an extent, but, I mean, one of the things I come back to is that George Lucas came up with Indiana Jones, and he was talking to Spielberg. They were vacationing together, and Spielberg wanted to do a James Bond movie, but... James Bond is the producers of James Bond are famously American averse, shall we say?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they wouldn't let him play with the James Bond toys. And George Lucas was like, well, I got an idea better than James Bond. And that's how, of course, James Bond famously is a role that trades actors to actors to actors.
Yeah.
You know, James Bond 6 is almost done. They'll be on to James Bond 7. And, you know, I think there's a lot of potential material there. I wouldn't mind, honestly, I wouldn't mind seeing like a new director and a new star sort of take on the character, just because I think there's a lot of potential there. And, you know, I think Harrison Ford in particular mentioned Chris Pine. I don't know if he meant Chris Pratt, who's often been sort of associated.
Yeah, who was basically Indiana Jones in the Jurassic
Park. Jurassic World movies, yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard somewhere, like, somebody talk about Bradley Cooper maybe doing it, and I find that interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I find Bradley Cooper interesting, period. No, I'll watch him in anything.
Yeah, no, so
it's... Bathrobe.
Bathrobe, the movie starring Bradley Cooper. Bradley Cooper as the dude. But no, it's... I find that, just as a contrarian, for him to go, like, there's no me but me. It's like, well, you're an actor, and really, like, no actor's bigger than, I think, the part.
Yeah, but let's think of the parts that Harrison Ford has had.
Okay.
I mean, Indiana Jones and Han Solo are, like, they are the zeitgeist.
Sure.
Right? And in a way, how much Harrison Ford is in those characters versus how much the character was in Harrison Ford, mm-hmm. right? It's I think it's okay for people to have signature characters and nobody can play them after. Mm. I mean, Solo the film was fine.
It was another okay one.
Yeah, it was fine.
Yeah,
but at the same time, I'm like, I mean, that to me, that's not Han Solo. That's just some other rogue in in the Star Wars universe. Like, I can't see him as Han Solo. Similarly with Indiana Jones, right? You could just create another character that's very similar, and it would be fine. I would just watch that, and nobody's ever going to be Indiana Jones.
Well, Solo, a Star Wars story, has prequelitis up the wazoo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, I don't want to slam the door on anything. I just, you know, maybe, I'm actually not that terribly interested in Indiana Jones 5. It's like, it's coming out 4 days before Harrison Ford turned 79. It's not to sound ageist at all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we kind of did that. Like, the whole point of Crystal Skull is like, we're going to do one more with old Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the
only
reason...
And then they hired Shia LaBeouf, which was...
Well, I don't
the real problem.
I don't think he's going to be back for part five.
That wasn't really the real problem. There were many problems.
Yeah. But yeah, the beef was one of them. But yeah, it's just we've kind of been there, done that. And if you want to keep making the Indiana Jones movies, that's fine. But you know what? Well, maybe turn the reins over and let somebody else have a turn. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break with some music of the familiar variety. And you'll try and suss out what this means. Anyway, it's fairly self-explanatory. We'll be right back. You're listening to End Credits here on CFI.
This alpha predator of yours, Doctor. Do you really think he has a chance?
The arrogance of man is thinking nature is in our control, and not the other way around. Let them fight.
And that was a clip from Godzilla from 2014 that launched 1,000 memes.
Mm-hmm.
Including some I used before that. Before that, though, we had Taron Egerton and Elton John doing Tiny Dancer. Taron Egerton singing, Elton John on piano.
And be honest, you were just singing it up at the top of your lungs, right? I mean, I was. It's true.
You, the listeners. Oh, fair enough. So both Rocket Man and Godzilla came out this past weekend, but we're going to talk about Godzilla for now, which is... one of these franchises that they've been expanded universe.
Thank God Harrison Ford has never played Godzilla.
Oh my goodness, could you imagine? But there was an article on The Ringer that did its best to explain why Godzilla is sort of this enduring symbol, this enduring franchise. And so, you know, it forces us to ask a question, you know, has the original intention of Godzilla been sort of lost in this mad scramble to franchise him, to make him, you know, kind of the hero monster we need, not the one we deserve. Or, you know, it just, because you look back at Godzilla 1954, the original one, it's horrific.
Well, and that's the thing, right? That's what, only like 5 or 6 years after the bombs of Hiroshima. I mean, Godzilla is such a blatant metaphor that
it's hard to miss it.
Nobody can miss it, right? And, you know, to be honest, I have not watched... I haven't watched a lot of the sort of original Japanese Godzilla films. I've seen them sort of here and there.
There are 32.
Yeah. But I certainly... But, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I know the history and the story and, you know, where and how and, you know, what he's representing, that sort of thing. I haven't really watched any of the new... I mean, I did see the terrible Matthew Broderick one.
Yeah.
The soundtrack was great. I own the soundtrack. I listen to it very regularly. Puff Daddy and Led Zeppelin, is that right?
Yeah, it was Jimmy Page.
Yeah. Listened to that a lot. I think I watched the movie once. I did not see the film that came out, what was it, 4 years ago, 5 years ago?
Yeah, Gareth Edwards.
Yeah, and the, like, Kong Skull Island.
Mm-hmm. Which is part of the same quote-unquote,
like,
universe.
Yeah. You know, I haven't watched any of these because... I am concerned, particularly about Godzilla, maybe not so much about King Kong, but I'm concerned about the Americanization of a horror for a country. Mm-hmm. A horror that was so bad they had to make it into one giant monster, which was tangible and you know, they could fight against.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just this Hollywood thing.
Yeah, it's the horror of the fallout of the atomic bombs is so indescribable, and nobody knew what the effect was going to be, dropping an atomic bomb on a population. And I think it's still on Netflix, so if you get a chance to see the BBC, it's like a part documentary, part recreation of the bombing of Hiroshima. It is harrowing. Especially when it gets to the scenes of, like, the immediate aftermath of the bomb. And, you know, when you kind of put those things in context, Godzilla's almost the only way you could deal with something like that, to put a face and a name on living with that horror years after fact. Although, you know, modern-day Hiroshima and Nagasaki are as beautiful and vibrant as any city you can find in the world. But I feel, as someone who saw the 2014 Godzilla and saw the 1998 Godzilla, saw it in theaters, his foot is as big as this bus. I still remember the advertising, too. I also remember, because I was working at Zellers at the time, we couldn't put out the Godzilla toys to, like, a certain day, because they were keeping, like, what the Godzilla character looked like under wraps. So it's like, don't open this box till May, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was crazy. Crazy times. But yeah, the 2014 Godzilla, I think, is probably the one that's gotten closest to finding some sort of sense of theme again. You know, I think, it's still sort of like heroizing Godzilla, because Godzilla fights two other monsters in it. But it gets close to sort of having a message that, you know, when atomic energy and atomic bombs are created, we unleashed a monster, or that's when these creatures started rising again. And there's a kind of a general sense that the creatures represent, and I've gathered this from the advertising for the Godzilla King of Monsters, which I haven't seen yet, but that there's sort of an existential threat that's comparable to something like, say, climate change. We did this, but we can't control it.
Yeah.
And that sounds perfectly reasonable, but at the same time, I also know there's a post-credit scene at the end of Godzilla King of Monsters that sets up Kong versus Godzilla, which comes out next year.
Yeah.
And so it's like this horrible, what I think is a very powerful message, and probably using Godzilla in the correct way, wrapped up in this horrible corporate shill packaging of, we've got more movies. Don't remember to come back next year for more movies. It's
The trailers, because I haven't seen the film either, the trailers look difficult to follow.
Yeah.
And I know that there are some people who have been complaining that there's not enough plot with the humans and too much fighting, which some of us, that's what we want out of a Godzilla film.
Right.
We want to see giants
which
fighting each other.
Which is the flip of the criticism of the first of the Gareth Edwards Godzilla movie. It's like, there's too much humans. Where's all the monster fighting?
Yeah, Hollywood, you're never going to get it right. Just make what you think is good art and the rest of us can fight it out. Exactly. it does look, you know, I've been sort of like, maybe I want to see it, maybe I don't. I like the idea of these giant monsters fighting. This looks like a lot of destruction in which humans are going to play zero part, which is sort of what I want. But I think more than that, it's just made me think, I should go watch the originals.
Yes.
I should do a deep dive into the original Godzilla.
Well, I mean, there's only a few of them that kind of have the serious tone. I haven't seen them all either, but, you know, most of them play fairly comedic. One of the films that I watched, like, when I was young was the Godzilla 1985, which was Toho's attempt to sort of relaunch Godzilla as a horror franchise and get away from, like, the Mecha Godzilla and the kind of silliness of the later in the series. I think, and they finally, there's been a rights thing where they haven't been able to release Godzilla 1985, which is the Americanized version with, like, Raymond Burr inserted, like they did with the original.
Yeah.
But they did release the Return of Godzilla, which is the original Japanese version, on DVD a couple of years ago. I found it at Cinema One, and
for $300.
No, actually, it was like under $20, which was nice.
Nothing is under $20 at Cinema One.
Well, unless it goes on sale, that's another story. Before we go to break and then do the review, last weekend a movie called Booksmart came out. Boy, do I wish we saw that instead of Aladdin. Moving on, it opened in sixth place at the box office and earned $6.9 million. A lot of people are saying that just because it's a victim of big box office monsters, shall we say, duking it out. I'm not sure that should be considered a failure. I mean, Olivia Wilde who's director of Booksmart, went on Twitter and made the point that, you know, opening weekend is sort of what matters to Hollywood. I don't think that's a non-existent point. I think she makes a good point, but I think that Booksmart is one of those movies that I think awaits discovery. And
we'll
have legs. Like, if it loses, you know, 5%, 10% of its box office versus something like Aladdin, which I haven't seen the box office numbers yet, but it would likely probably lost 50 to 60% over from one week to the other, you know.
Yeah. It's tough, though, for those smaller films that have legs to stay long enough in the theater.
Right.
And, I mean, to me, this is a little bit of an argument for, we almost need two theater systems. I mean, we do sort of, because there's the first run and the second run cinema. And we're very lucky in Guelph that we have a second run cinema here.
Yes.
And there are a lot of other places that do have a second run cinema, and they are, I think, becoming more popular again. They kind of died for a bit and are sort of coming back. But even more than just the first run and second run, I almost feel like there should be, like, the blockbuster cinema and then the movies that you might, you know, the quieter movies.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't remember what I was seeing, but I was talking about it when I was on the show that I went, and I was like, six theaters in this 10-theater building are showing Avengers.
Yeah.
Like, no, I don't understand. For one thing, not every single one of those shows can be sold out. Like,
no.
I know that they have, you know, different theaters for, like, the 3D and then the 2D and then the AVX or whatever. But still, like, it could show in three theaters, maybe four theaters. Like, what are you doing when a 10-screen building, 60% is one movie? I'm like, oh, I would love to go see a movie this weekend. Oh, look, the three movies I've seen already are the only three movies playing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just really frustrating to me.
Well, I'd also add that there's also a second Galaxy Cinema in the South End, and I Avengers was probably on 2 of the 6 screens there. Yeah. So it's, you know, how many screens do you need?
I want to see this film. And yeah. I will say, I heard about it because I listen to podcasts. And so the two actors who were in it were on a podcast called... Were they on Nerdette? They might have been on Nerdette podcast. And it sounded great. It sounded charming and funny. And I was actually surprised when I was reading a little bit more about it to go, oh, it's like a raunchy comedy. It didn't really sound like a raunchy comedy the way they were all sort of talking about it. Mm. Like, it certainly sounded like a comedy, but like, you know, something, you know, like Lady Bird, but lighthearted.
Yeah.
I mean, right, I think I laughed once or twice in Lady Bird, yeah. mostly at Laurie Metcalf.
But yeah, no, understandable.
But yeah, so, I mean, I think that there are alternate marketing mechanisms mm-hmm. to get these sort of films in front of the people who are going to want to see it. Because some of the people who are seeing Avengers in 1 of 6 screens might also want to see this film. But a good number of them probably will never see this film. They don't want to. Mm-hmm. So why even sort of put it in the same category, in the same thing, and then try to judge it based on the same success metrics?
Right. I think the studio that released it was probably thinking about counter-programming, but it's hard to, you know, maybe against something like John Wick, it would be counter-programming because, you know, mm-hmm. you're going as a couple, and do you want to see this, like, nice, lighthearted comedy about two high school girls on their last night of high school, or do you want to see, you know, Keanu Reeves kill 150 people?
Can I say both?
You can make it a double bill, I guess. but, you know, there's a difference between sort of counter-programming that way and then counter-programming against something like Aladdin, which is kind of like purpose-built to get as many people into that screening in the first weekend as humanly possible.
Because it's terrible and nobody wants to see it a second time. I don't know. I have no idea.
Fair.
To be fair, I think I've only watched the Disney version, the original animated version, once or twice.
Well, you can always go and see the live-action one, and it's like seeing the original animated all over again. Anyway.
Yeah.
We'll take a break there and then come back with something completely different. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
From a decoy.
Long story short, don't let your kids
mow the lawn.
Yeah, no. Hire somebody for that. That was a clip from Brightburn, the new film from David Yurodesky, and stars Elizabeth Banks, David Denman, Jackson Dunn, Matt Jones, and Meredith Hagner. And alternative title, I guess, is Evil Superman.
Mm-hmm.
From the Brothers Gunn.
it's the Brothers and Cousin Gunn.
Okay. I didn't know one was cousin.
Yeah. Yeah. So James and Brian are brothers yes. And Mark Gunn is a cousin. And Sean Gunn. No Sean Gunn to be seen in this film.
Although there is a Michael Rooker cameo.
Yeah.
At the end.
That was great.
With, Michael Rooker as like Alex Jones, basically.
It was amazing.
Which I could see that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just want to do like an Alex Jones biopic with Michael Rooker.
That hair, though, I don't know. I was not down with Rooker's hair.
No, it's the... No. I just want to see Michael Rooker, like, as he normally looks.
Yeah.
And just, like, have him play Alex Jones, mm-hmm. but as Michael Rooker. Because
mm-hmm.
I feel like that's perfect.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yeah.
What do we think about Brightburn?
You know, I think that particular clip that you chose mm-hmm. Highlights... There were a lot of good things, and there were some not great things about the film. And I think that mm-hmm. clip actually highlights two things, one that I really like and one that I found to be a little troublesome. Mm-hmm. And so one being the gore and or the threat of gore.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't find this film to be scary in a jump scare sort of way. There were a couple of them, but they, you know, so it wasn't scary in that sort of way, but it was scary in a tense way where... You always thought you're about to see like horrible, violent gore on screen. And sometimes you did,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's good too, because since you did see it sometimes, there was always the like, oh my God. And so as he's reaching for and what's ridiculous about it is we're all pretty sure we know what's going to happen, not
yeah.
only because it's in the trailer, but also because we already understand the premise that he is this like...
evil Superman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we know what's going to happen. When he puts his hand in that blade, it's not going to do anything. But yet it was just so well executed
mm-hmm.
that you're like, oh, my God, oh, my God. And one of the things that I think could have worked but didn't work as well as I wanted it to was, you know, those voices, that kind of evil voice that you hear.
Mm.
And the idea that, you know, his actions were sort of triggered by... something, because he wakes up in the middle of the night and he's having dreams and he hears the voice, and you know, for quite a while he's hearing that voice, which is causing him to do bad things. Which it's not that I wanted an explanation of like where he came from or where any of that was, but it's just sort of like it felt like they were kind of going down one path and then maybe not, and it's like, is he evil? Is it just in him? Is it, you know, like coded in him, or is it something else? Like, I feel like they could have made a decision.
Yeah, they didn't trust the core concept to go like full good son.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, you know, because I feel like when you go back to Superman, and it's hard to separate the two, you know, just from the iconography and, you know, the way they sort of beautifully shoot the farm and the mailbox, it's meant to. You know, the golden light, the sort of the magic hour, it seems like certain portions are shot specifically,
mm-hmm.
you know, and in that to provoke a certain sense of Americana. So you can't really separate Superman. Going back to that character, though, you get a sense that when you see Krypton, where Superman is from, and this goes for like the comic books and the Donner movie and just about all the material, that you get the sense that it's not such a great place, that it's, you know, the people there are kind of divorced from emotion, kind of divorced from reality from a certain extent. Mm-hmm. So sort of Jor-El is the exception.
Yep.
Superman's Kryptonian father is the exception. When he comes to Earth, he lands in the, you know, near a kindly farm couple who instill with him the typical American values of truth, mm-hmm. justice, looking out for the little guy, being protector and all that. So what you have, you know, so what Superman is doesn't necessarily come from his powers. It's how people have sort of instructed him and how to best use his powers. And when I saw the trailers for this and saw the concept, although it's not, you know, in the trailers, it's pretty clear that Elizabeth Banks is a good mom.
Yes.
What they should have, and maybe this might have played a bit too close to expectations, is what happened if Superman landed somewhere and he's found by people who are petty and greedy,
mm-hmm.
and terrible, and who might have like abused him. What does that person grow up to be? What is their point of view of humanity from there? And does that person, with all their power,
mm-hmm.
become someone who might crash a plane because he can?
And I mean, I am okay with it not being that way, with these being good parents,
mm-hmm.
and there's just something inside him that is bad.
Mm-hmm.
I would be okay with that, except I feel like they still wouldn't even go that far.
No, like there's an external force.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, even still, they weren't showing him struggle with, you know, I want to be good. Why am I hearing these things or seeing these things or wanting to do these things? I want to be good. Mm-hmm. And I think they could have played with that a bit more. What's interesting about this film is that when I saw the runtime of 90 minutes, I thought, that's perfect. 90 minutes is exactly right for a horror film. It's great. Yeah. In and out. And then I would say probably around the 75-minute mark or something, I was like, I feel like I've been here a while, but I feel like there's still a lot of story to be told. How are they going to make this an hour and a half long film? And I think that they could have made it a little bit longer. Mm. And there was definitely some pacing issues. There was a lot that happened. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not that I need explanation necessarily, but I feel like there was pacing, and they should have made some things a little bit longer, and sort of dove a little deeper, I think, into the psyche of this kid.
Yeah, I think I don't think it's a problem with the way the kid plays it. I think the kid is really good. But yeah, there's times where he puts on a show, like he does the sociopath thing, where he's like, oh, I'm like really sorry. And then there are times where his aunt is also his teacher, his teacher's also his aunt, where he's like sitting there like...
Small town.
Yeah, where he's like sitting there like going, oh, I don't feel bad at all. Whatever. And you know, So which one is it? Are you putting on the show that you're like a kid, that you're covering up your sociopathy or whatever is going on? Or are you like just going to be the brat that just doesn't care?
And I
think the problem stems from the fact that it's sort of like an external source and that is driving him. And so you're never quite sure, like, is he in the driver's seat? And does he at what point does the ship influence end? And at what point does him saying like, hey, I like this. I like using my power to, you know, just kill people and do mean things and, you know, crush a girl's hand, you know, cause she called me a freak. And
yeah,
I think a lot of people would get that. I think I think some parents out there would probably get enjoy the sort of, like the good son, just seeing a kid be absolutely horrible, because I'm sure there are a lot of parents out there who maybe feel like this, that, you know, there are times when the kid gets out of hand and you think that it's being driven by some, you know, internal need to destroy or wreck or ruin your life or what have you. And you could have leaned into that. And I don't know whether they were just afraid of, like, you know, in an era where we're always hearing about child abuse or what have you, of like, painting just like a kid who has to be destroyed. He's bad. Or whether it's just, they wanted to, I don't know, have an external factor just so that, you know, they cover themselves and that, you know, they don't get, you know, the moral majority, you know, chasing them down.
Yeah.
That, you know, oh, you can't make all kids evil. This is bad. You are bad.
Yeah. I mean, it's no surprise that all of this starts as he turns 12, you know, which is for both boys and girls, you know, puberty and going into it is horrible. And, you know, you don't even recognize yourself, you know, like I remember being a teenager. I thought I was a pretty good kid. And then I would like say things to my parents and go to my room and I'd be so mad at them. But then also like, what did I just do? Like that? Yeah. Who am I? So, you know, I think that there could have been a lot more. Yeah, I think I still sort of come back to the characterization of Brandon was his name, right?
Yes.
The characterization of Brandon could have just been a little bit deeper, you know, and it started that way with, you know, he's got the girl who has a crush on. And so then he inappropriately shows her that he has a crush on her in a really like not
an
good
okay
way.
And as soon
but
as...
makes total sense.
Right.
But then, yeah, I mean...
And it also comes from, like, from the dad, David Denman, like, stumbling through the talk. Like,
oh
it's
gosh.
Okay to give in to your urges.
So awkward.
I almost face-palmed there.
Yeah.
It's like, it's okay to give in to your urges sometimes. It's like, oh, Okay.
Yeah.
Good work, Dad. Yeah.
I will say another one of the things that they got so right with this film, and I really appreciated, was the parents.
Yeah.
And the emotion around it, right? Mm-hmm. The depth of caring and love they had for their son, mm-hmm. at the same time that they were scared of him, and you know, the actions that were taken by both parents felt really emotional. Mm-hmm. Like they really played those scenes out really well, where you felt what the parent was feeling at that moment when they were trying to do something about it. It's like, wow, that is a horrible feeling. Mm-hmm. How do you even get to that place where you have to?
And it's not even just about, you know, Brendan having superpowers. It, you know, there's a scene where the dad is looking at like old cards and pictures and old, like, mm-hmm. artwork that Brendan did, and is like weeping.
Yeah.
And you could read that a number of ways. You can read that as, you know, my son growing up, and you know, mm-hmm. How any dad might react after a typical argument with their now teenage child. Or you could take that as, you know, what happens later in the film,
yeah.
where the dad makes a very consequential decision. You know, sort of him like fighting the realization of what he thinks he has to do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's, I mean, that really works well on a couple of levels. And I think Elizabeth Banks too, there's a lot of great stuff with her, and like the scene in the principal's office, and it's in the trailer, but it's a longer scene where the girl's mom, you know, says, mm-hmm. "Do you even know who her real mother is?" And she's like, "Well, I'm his real mom," and you know.
And I love that because she snaps back, right? Because she's in that room, and you can tell she is questioning, like, "What has he done?
Right?
What is going on?"
Yes.
Oh, and you know, she's questioning her own son at that moment,
mm-hmm.
but then the second she's challenged,
yes,
she's like, "Nope, I'm his mother."
That's right.
Which is, I mean, it's amazing, right? And it shows the love of a parent that mm-hmm. you know, you can, like, I am here for you. Even if you've done something, we're gonna work through it. We're gonna fix it, but we're gonna do it together. And I am always gonna be mm-hmm. your parent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really impressed with that part of the film quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. No, it's there's a lot of good stuff in it. I wish it was sort of counterbalanced. Like, there's a lot of I don't know how to explain it, but like there's a lot of developments where the audience is ahead of the script,
mm-hmm.
But the script doesn't think you're that smart. you find out about a certain weakness Brendan has,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, oh, okay, that's going to come into play later.
Yeah, I know,
but
right?
Then, like, there's a scene later where Elizabeth Banks has the realization, and it's like a 30-minute stretch where you kind of see her put the pieces together in your head. It's like, Elizabeth Banks.
Like,
come on, Elizabeth Banks. You know what's going on. You know what you have to do. And then there's also a similar scene because Brendan leaves a tag at the mm-hmm. scene of all his kills, which is another one of these things that, you know, if he was struggling with his evil, he probably wouldn't sign his evil work.
Yeah.
But where the sheriff's like looking at it and looking at these pictures, the crime scene photos. Also Polaroids. Like, are we still taking Polaroids at crime scene?
They might be those Nikon or Fuji.
Oh, man.
Fuji has the Insta pics now.
All right. Fine. I don't think actual crime scene techs would use that, even in the Boondocks, but that's fine. But he's looking at the sigil, and it's like, it looks like a mirror reflection of a bee, and it's like, you see the sheriff working in, it's like, bee, backwards, bee, Brendan Breyer?
Yeah.
And then it's like, yes, it's a bee. They're bees. We know they're bees. Figure it out, Sheriff.
Yeah. Though, you know what? It could have been ours, because I was a Ross Royal, and our thing was the R and R back to back. Looked less creepy.
All right.
Than the written in blood.
Chances are, though, you didn't, you know, kill your uncle in a truck accident and then like draw the symbol on the road in his blood.
No, I don't remember having done that.
Good.
Yeah.
I do want to say that if you're the squeamish type.
Yeah, Gore-a-palooza.
And I'm not generally the squeamish type, but the eye thing, the glass
yeah.
in the
yeah,
eye.
Yeah, I didn't
couldn't watch that.
I didn't watch it. Nope. No. My eyes were closed. Same thing with the truck accident. It was just like, nope, I'm not watching. But I loved that they did it. Like, you know, I do think the gore in this was great.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm okay with not watching it, just knowing that it was there. But, like...
Yeah,
it was pretty well done.
Yeah.
I mean, on the whole, I think this film could have been better,
mm-hmm.
but was pretty good.
Yeah, it was all right. I think it's worth checking out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only 90 minutes, so it's not it's not a huge investment of time. But...
I will just say, mm-hmm. I've read that there's potential for like spin-off from this, and No, I don't want it. No.
Well, it clearly sets up an evil Justice League with the Michael Rooker.
It's terrible. I don't want it.
No, I don't think I want it either, but that's fine. What is fine is that we will continue to franchise our own show. And if you like it, you can listen to it again. You can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, or you can download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at just End Credits Radio. I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on open sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And until then, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson or check out my political site, GuelphPolitico.ca. And where can people find you on the internet, Candace?
I am available everywhere at Sin48, that's CINN48. And sometime this week, there should be a new episode of the Village Podcast from the Bookshelf,
yes.
Our excellent second-run cinema, amongst other things.
Yep. Also a bookstore, I hear.
I hear that, too. That will soon have an elevator.
Yes.
For accessibility nerds.
Yes.
That's great.
Yes, that's good. That is very good news. A long time in coming. Mm-hmm. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. And we will see you then.